I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there. Dr. G works with some of the highest level athletes, some of the highest level leaders, and offers this opportunity, this framework, to be able to consider how do we actually optimize performance.
Well, you know, one of the things that I tell my athletes in particular that I get to work with is make everything your advantage, everything. No matter what happens, make that your advantage. One of the greatest stories to me is Steph Curry, who broke his ankle, you know, a few years in and relearned how to shoot. And that's when he became, you know, arguably the greatest shooter in the NBA history.
Right? I didn't know that.
And so it's through these points of trauma that we take ownership of that we excel through. But the key variable there is that we take ownership of. Mm-hmm. Right? And have a sense of control. Take the choice to look at every struggle as an opportunity. Then we've got a much better chance to prosper.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves podcast. Today I have Dr. Mark Guadagnoli. How did I do?
Well done.
Was that pretty good?
Well, it was great.
Straight actually. Out of Italy?
Yeah. I actually thought you were Italian there for a second.
I was. Spaghetti, ravioli. Can you, for the listeners, give them some background on what you do? Because you got many titles. You're a man, a myth, a legend.
my day job, so to speak, is I'm the dean of faculty for the Kirk Corian School of Medicine at UNLV, professor of neuroscience and neurology also at the School of Medicine. I do some coaching with high-level performers, right? So they could be athletes, corporate executives, obviously some of the medical folks, trauma surgeons, so forth, and an author.
Yeah, because, you know, when I think about why people listen to this podcast, but in general, why people consume personal growth content, how to be better at things, it's really this pursuit of seeking optimization. And I think we like the idea of that, but the practicalities of that are a little different. And what I love about your work is there is a tangibility or a strategy and a science behind actually what creates optimal way of being or optimal performance. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you saying it. I think that comes from practicality. I mean, I'm human like everybody else. And there are, you know, I know certain things that I don't do. Are good for me, right? I mean, just like anybody else. And so one of the things that's really fascinating to me, for a long time, it was fascinating to me to understand how to optimize anything that somebody wanted to optimize, right? And then it became really, from a science perspective, and then it became really interesting is, well, I know this stuff, but I don't necessarily do all this stuff. So why is that?
Seems to be pretty true of a lot of us. We have knowledge, but not application.
Yeah. And so creating one of the things that has helped me a lot and then helped people, you know, with whom I've had the good fortune to work is is creating systems and rituals rather than willpower around things, and tapping into something that's very primal. Because I think the more often we can do that, instead of use our intellect to try and bully ourselves into doing the things we know we should do, it just seems to work easier.
Seems like one of those is associated with sort of shame from, like, I'm going to do this because I know I have to, because I read it and these are the strategies, you know, these are the simple steps to do something. I know I should not, let's say, have a Slurpee. But if I can actually put in rituals and practices that come from a place of wanting to feel connected to myself, integrated. Also, once you start applying these things, it's pretty hard to go back.
Yeah, you know, so Slurpees are a really good example of this.
They're
because
so tasty. I haven't had one in years.
I still remember actually the brain freeze that you can get from these.
Yeah.
But so this is actually a really good example because of two different things that I think about. One, the easy one, intellectually easy, is asking a different question than we normally ask. Like we would say, hey, do I want a Slurpee? The answer is yes.
Yeah, that's true.
I want a Slurpee more than I want the life that I've chosen to live, right? Those are two very different questions. That's like, do I want to wake up at 6 o'clock when my alarm goes off? Or do I want to wake up or do I want to lay in bed more than I want the life that I dream of, right? So those are different questions. So I think that that's one of the ways about it, right? Where you could create a habit around that when you know something that you're about to do isn't in your best interest and ask the which do I want more question. But the other reason why I think the Slurpee thing is really interesting, Slurpees have lots of sugar in them, right? And one of the things that we know is that when you ingest sugar, you are feeding the biome, the gut biome that specifically targets sugar, and it grows that biome, but part of the biome grows to then entice you to get more sugar.
Smart.
It's brilliant. You know,
it's like the sugar monster.
The sugar monster,
which
right.
I'm sure is the scientific term.
It's similar to the zombie wasp. Do you know this? The fly lays its larva in the brain of a wasp, and then basically the larva controls the wasp to do what it wants so that it lives for a while so the larva can...
It's like under the command of the larvae.
Yeah, which is crazy, right? But to some extent, we're that way. That's under the command of the gut biome that specifically is addictive to sugar, right? So if we can stay away from sugar for a relatively short period of time, 3-4 days, then that basically sort of loses its power on us because most of that dies off and we're fine. But, you know, but if we go back to sugar, we're back in that cycle, right? And so one of the things that's really interesting, like the Slurpee deal, like I haven't even thought of having a Slurpee in decades, probably, right?
Same.
But there was a time where every time I walked in, back in the day, it was a 7-Eleven. Every time I walked in the 7-Eleven, right? It's like, oh man, there's Slurpee.
Good Coke, Slurpee. Yeah, and I would always mix
them and so forth. That's not even the least bit intriguing. It's becoming a little bit intriguing as we're talking about it. But,
yeah, I was thinking that too.
But the thing is that at some point, that no longer was my habit.
Same.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of the process that allowed me to choose other things. I think it was the level of knowledge that I got about nutrition and what that was really doing to me. You know, when you're young, especially in junior high or, you know, our education system, 99.9% of the time is not educating us on nutrition. I mean, we're not really being educated in our formative years on all the things that truly matter. Not to say that there's not value in the education we get. But we're not being trained on relationships, we're not being trained on finances, and we're not being trained on nutrition. Mm-hmm. And I would argue those three things are, especially relationships, and especially nutrition, are pretty core to our habits that are core to our well-being.
Yeah, and I would actually put relationships number one, because including relationships with ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because if we don't have that set, those other things will go just down the shitter, right?
Yeah,
because
they will.
if you think about the relationship with money, right? Finances that you said, if you live from a scarcity mindset, you can't have enough money, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have money, you can't spend it because you live from a scarcity mindset, right? So it's a dysfunctional relationship with money that stems from a dysfunctional foundation that we have, that the individual has. So I think, I agree with you 100%, but I think at the base of that pyramid is the relationship that we have with ourselves.
I think at the, when we're starting to assess things like optimal performance, and we're trying to, let's say, become the best at relationship, the best at a sport, being able to apply something that seems like fundamental practices, I think we'd all like that recipe. You know, like ultimately what I like about your work is, although a lot of people see it from a sports performance mm-hmm. perspective, but when I started to see your work, yeah, I could see the application as an athlete, but I was also like, this is true of any relationship, that everything requires some level of discomfort. And I was thinking about the sugar, right? Like if I could sit for 3 or 4 days and not follow the question to get sugar and be with the longing for sugar, I get to learn who I am in the longing and what I'm capable of. And I heard the other day a quote about what is discipline. That discipline is trading something that you want right now for something that you truly want in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's such a simple way of framing it. So I'm curious, because I think there's always a path to this, is what made you desire to even understand on a fundamental level what creates high performers?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. By the way, the discipline thing, I think another piece of that is discipline is an act of self-love as well, right?
Mm.
Which is one of the reasons why, you know, you got back, you said shame earlier. One of the reasons why some of us don't do it or don't do it on a regular basis, because to do that would be to honor ourselves. And some people don't feel as if they deserve that honor. And so
that's true.
You know, it gets back to what you said earlier about how important relationships are in relationship with self. But so to answer the question about peak performance, you know, I don't know, to be honest, but I was an athlete growing up and I cared much, much more about that than I did about a lot of things, certainly more than I did about school. And so I think some of it was, you know, for personal reasons, like I wanted to figure out how I could be better. But just in general, it's always been something where I've been fascinated with learning things, learning information that then I could give away to people, including myself, to give away to people to help them be better. And one of my great frustrations is when people don't want to be better. They choose not to be. Actually, I'll tell you, I got a message from a friend the other day, which reminded me of this. Her name's Tricia Collins. And we, when I was in graduate school in my PhD program, we were having this conversation and I remember distinctly where we were and the conversation, this part of the conversation that I'm going to tell you. And I don't know what started it and so forth, but I said, yeah, but Trish, if you don't do that, you're never going to be as good as you can be. And she said, you don't get it, do you, Mark? Not everybody wants to be as good as they can be. And I'm like, what? Like that was literally the first time that I ever thought of that. And she's right, right? There are a lot of people who don't. There are a lot of people who would wish for it, but to do the work for it,
and they're
they
not
don't,
willing.
Right? Yeah. And it's not even like we're in categories, like either you do or you don't. It's a spectrum.
It's
right?
Also not a hierarchy, right? No. As you're saying,
yeah.
Which I think is when we can accept that not everyone wants what we want. Not everyone wants to learn from relationship.
Yeah.
Not everyone wants discomfort.
Exactly right. And really, who are we to judge, right? But,
right.
But
otherwise it becomes moralizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that those people who do want to be better, there's something really fulfilling to me to be able to have the information, be able to give that to people, right? No matter what it is. And so I try not to judge in that situation if they don't want to be, mm-hmm. but if they do want to be, I want to be able to help.
Well, I think for you listening too, like Dr. G, if I may, it works with some of the highest level athletes, some of the highest level leaders, and offers this opportunity, this framework to be able to consider how do we actually optimize performance. And what I love, as I said earlier, is that it's applicable no matter where you put it. So for the person listening, what is sort of what's a good task or a good outcome that would be a great way to explain challenge point theory?
It applies to a lot of different areas like you're talking about, and there are layers to it. But I'll give you what I think is probably the simplest way to think about it. Mm-hmm. If I'm lifting weights, okay, so I'm weight training. I go into the gym, I have a certain weight, so I'm going to say 100 pounds on the bench press, right? And I can lift that weight, do bench press 10 times at 100 pounds, and it's a struggle, especially 7, 8, 9, 10, right, reps. It's a struggle, but I can do it. And then at that point, there's a couple of things that are happening. One of them is that, like I said, I'm struggling. And so my performance doesn't look very good, right? Especially towards the end. The other thing about it is that there's growth that's resulting from that. Mm-hmm. Now, if I can bench press 100 pounds 10 times, but I choose to put 50 pounds on and do that 10 times, I'm going to look really good, but mm-hmm. I'm not going to be gaining very much.
Right.
If I put 200 pounds on, I'm going to look bad. And I'm not going to be gaining, and I'll probably hurt myself, right? So there is an optimal state, in this case, an optimal weight for me to be stressed in that area. We've talked about hermetic stress before, that stress that in little doses is bad for us, is good for us. If it's too much or too little, it's bad for us, right? So optimal challenge point says that if we are challenged optimally, which yields short-term struggle for long-term gain. And it gets back to what you said at the very beginning, and that is, you know, discipline. Discipline mindset around that. And so in this case, your optimal challenge point may be that 100 pounds that you're using for the mm-hmm. bench press, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you keep doing that 100 pounds for 2 months, now you're going to be suboptimal because you've gained some strength, but you haven't increased increased the struggle. And so one of the keys to this is you have to increase the struggle as you increase your abilities. And so it's a moving target, which turns out to be actually a really good thing. Mm-hmm. But if you're willing to do that, that's where you optimize gain. You know, we're using weight training as an example, but it could be learning any kind of a motor skill like golf. It could be learning skills like music. It could be learning academics. It could be, you know, you're bringing up this point, which I think is great. It could be relational, right? Right.
How do you handle conflict? The ability to navigate nervous system dysregulation. Like just, I recently interviewed Sarah Baldwin, who's an expert on the nervous system. And she talked about increasing your capacity for small tolerable steps.
Yes.
Which I think is like a lot of us avoid any form of dysregulation. I think our society, in terms of how we monitor what conversations we can have, they're really dictated by if it causes any emotional dysregulation, then we should not be having them. But I think they're, you know, going back to one of my favorite books, The Coddling of the American Mind, one of the arguments that Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff make is that it's actually the accommodation of emotions that is making it so we're not growing, that our capacity for difference is actually making us dumber, mm-hmm. which I think that's a different way of saying exactly like, how do we challenge ourselves enough that our relationships begin to thrive? Families that can handle conflict thrive, that hold conflict as a space of learning. So I wonder, what are the psychological predispositions that are important to be able to orient to challenge from that perspective?
So challenge point framework, right? The original paper that was promoted this idea, challenge point framework said, basically, if you practice or study or whatever it is you're trying to learn, a particular way, this challenge point way, you'll learn 3 or 4 times faster than normal, and it'll be stress resistant, which means that it'll hold up under stress. That's the science of it.
So when you're under duress, the skill set will be more accessible.
Correct.
Interesting.
And so, and the interesting thing is this idea has been tested in hundreds of research studies, not mine, like a bunch of people did research studies.
You created the framework and then people started to test it in all these different...
Yeah, we did some early testing of it and found the basis, and that's what the framework was set on. But yeah, you're right. And then people with physical therapy and individuals with Parkinson's and elite level performers and novice performers and children and adults and all these different categories,
cool.
Right?
Yeah.
And over and over and over again, it played out. So the science says, like, it boils down to, if you can create about 65% success rate during practice, then you're optimizing learning for the most part, right? And what that does is it stresses the system enough that it increases attention, it increases arousal state, it gets the neural cocktail in the brain to where it needs to be able to learn at an optimal state. And so we learn much, much faster, and we're used to dealing with stress, right? All of those kinds of things. But the fact is that 65%, even 70%, that's, for some people, they're not going to handle that. They're going to get frustrated and demoralized by that. And so even though the science says around 65%, the psychology may say, let them have 75% or 80%.
Will each person have a more subjective line of what's a tolerable failure rate, let's say, or success rate?
Yeah, I love this question, because what they should have, like that 65-70%, that's just the way it is. But what's tolerable, the psychology of it, exactly what you're asking, that's going to be very individualistic, right? So the framework scales to all individuals because it's based on their level of struggle. But the psychology of it, that's much more variable about it. And that's where it kind of moves from the science of the challenge point framework to the art of being a teacher or coach.
Yeah, it's interesting, because you think of adverse childhood experiences, right? And the research on that showing that the more adverse childhood experiences you have, the more likely you're to have things like autoimmune. But what is also interesting is, I forget where I was reading this. It's from the book Buy Back Your Time by Dan Martell. And he was talking about how that entrepreneurs tend to be people who had challenging experiences, because let's say your mom didn't pick you up from school and you had to learn how to get home, like that they were challenged through their childhood. And he really, because he came from a challenging experience, he's reframing that, hey, we can actually go through those things and learn resilience. But I wouldn't say that's always true, because our capacity, like you were saying earlier, if we're operating from a place of lower self-worth, that our capacity for failure, especially if our mindset is the world happens to me, it's not fair, which is not dismissing life's traumas that create that type of perspective or mindset, but that if we can begin to work with what is a tolerable step for someone and navigate that subjective lens of capacity for failure, that we ideally would push them forward. But I would imagine from a coaching perspective, there has to be the desire to orient to life from what can I learn from it? Because without that, you know, you're just going to keep hitting that challenge point. Eventually, you just won't put yourself in challenge.
Yeah, at the very least, it's much more difficult.
Yeah,
in that situation, if the person isn't willing to struggle to gain, it's much more difficult to coach that person. So one of the things that's interesting about what you're saying, and there's a really cool science, there's a guy named Seeley that does a lot of this, or has done a lot of this work. They found that if you have a medium level of trauma, and so we're talking about sort of normal traumas that happen along life, medium level of trauma, you're much more likely to be resilient and be able to minimize future traumas as far as the severity of them and feel a sense of control rather than a sense of lack of control in traumatic situations and so forth and so on. And there's a huge, huge body of literature that talks about it. But this is perfectly aligned with Challenge Point, right? You know, we've talked about this a little bit, the book that I'm working on right now, that the essence of the book talks about there's an optimal state, just like Challenge Point, there's an optimal state for anything, including the level of trauma you have in a given period of time or across your life. And the thing that's really interesting about that is it's not, if you have zero trauma or very little trauma, it's a disadvantage. If you have a great deal of trauma, it's a disadvantage.
Right.
Something in between is the advantage, right?
And that makes sense.
And again, that's perfectly aligned with Challenge Point. And it's also aligned, by the way, with, you know, the golden mean and the, and Aristotle's, you know, ideas of, you know, in moderation and all of these things. Like, this is not new.
The hero's journey.
The hero's journey, yeah. Right? It's not new. The thing about the hero's journey is if they don't have trauma along the way, they're not a hero. They're just a lucky person.
Like every good movie has that exact arc of the story.
Yeah.
Because there's like a low, we think they're going to lose. And then all of a sudden it's the rise, comeback, Rocky, all those. And I think when we can start to see that, hey, maybe what happens to us isn't fair, but it happened to us. Now, I would say to people, like, you have this choice. You can either orient to what happened from a place of like, that never should have happened to me, which means you're fighting reality.
And being a victim.
Right. Or you say, okay, I was dealt these cards. Cards sucked. But when I think about the most expansive moments of my life, they came from the darkest, hardest things that I think they are, if you are willing to alchemize and excavate, they are where all or the majority of the wisdom dwells. And you think of the people who inspire us, they usually come from those places where they have dug deep and they are like, hey, here's how you go. Here's how you do this. What I love about a scientific framework is it's like, oh, there's actually a systematic purpose. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It kind of depersonalizes it to say, hey, actually, you're at the perfect challenge point. I read this research from Dr. Mark Guadagnoli. Oh, I got it. I'm so Italian. But it's like, I read this research. This is actually the optimal point. And the person's like, oh, wait, what? So if you're listening and you're like going through some stuff, challenges are the way that we create, that we become.
You know, what's interesting about this is all of that's true if you have the right mindset around it, right? So I agree with you that the one of the greatest opportunities we have for growth is in the most difficult times. But you have to have the mindset that you're willing to embrace that and have a sense of control over it. So I'm going to tell you, this is one of my favorite and least favorite studies I've ever heard of. I was just talking about this the other day with a friend. It's my least favorite because it has to do with shocking dogs. But the results are really interesting. So they have two dogs. They're in kennels right next to each other. And they're normal kennels. The dogs are the same breed, same age, same gender, everything, right? They try to have this exact same as much as they could between the two. So the only difference, both of them have a shock pad. So there's the grates, there's floor. Electric grates in the floor so that they can shock the dogs. One dog has this little pad on the grate. And if it steps on that pad, it stops the shock for both dogs. So importantly, the two dogs are shocked the exact same amount of time. And the only difference between the two is whether or not this one can step on the pad.
So the one has an out.
Correct. But it shuts it off for both dogs.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
So they shock the dogs for, you know, 30 minutes or however long. And obviously it's painful and so forth. Pretty quickly, though, the dog with the pad is kind of hovering around the pad. And as soon as the shock happens, it will hit it, right? So it's a fairly short shock. But nevertheless, right, it shocks them and they don't like this. The study's over. They open the kennel doors. The dog that had the little pad in sort of sniffs around for a bit and wags his tail. And eventually, you know, a couple minutes later, comes out and gets petted and is playing and everything seems fine. The other dog cowers in its kennel. And then eventually they'll sort of pull it out and it'll run across the room and hide in the corner and pee on itself. And it's just, it's horrible.
Dysregulated, right? Yeah.
But the thing that's interesting is what happened to those two dogs was exactly the same. The sense of control was different.
Mm.
And for humans, you know, fortunately, we're not in that shock experiment, but for humans, it's not so much what happens to us, but the control that we feel that we have in the situation. And well, you know, one of the things that I tell my athletes in particular that I get to work with is make everything your advantage, everything. No matter what happens, make that your advantage. We had a guy who is a golfer and he broke his wrist. And our conversation was around, okay, how's that your advantage? As a person who feels victimized by that, or it's unfair, it's like, it's not an advantage. I can't practice, you know, I'm going to be behind these other guys, et cetera, et cetera. But we got to the point where we're talking, well, you know what? I actually really need to work on my lower body strength because I know that that's limiting in my golf swing. And my flexibility is as well. And he would have worked on those things if he hadn't have broken his wrist. One of the greatest stories to me is Steph Curry, who broke his ankle, you know, a few years in and relearned how to shoot. And that's when he became, you know, arguably the greatest shooter in the NBA history.
Right? I didn't know that.
And so it's through these points of trauma that we take ownership of that we excel through. But the key variable there is that we take ownership of, mm-hmm. right? And have a sense of control. So what you're saying, I think, is exactly right. We match, there is an optimal state of trauma, discomfort, you know, hormesis that we know from science. Then what we do with it because of our psychology, that's the differentiator. That's the difference between people who rise out of every single circumstance and the people who choose not to rise out of every circumstance.
What do you notice when you work with, because I know you worked with Zappos, helping build their culture, you worked with Tony Hsieh, you work with tons of elite athletes. What do you notice is the difference even in how this orients to a culture? Because I think as an individual, I get it. I'm sure the listener is understanding that. But how do you do that as a team? Like, how does that become the basis of a family, the basis of a relational culture? Like, is it about setting agreements? Like, what is it?
You know, I was going to go a different direction, but as soon as you said setting agreements, I think that becomes really important. And, you know, one of the agreements that we've been talking about is the agreement that a situation won't control me. I will control within the situation, mm-hmm. right? And so that's a personal agreement, but as a group of people, that becomes really important. I think that one of the things, you know, you see this in a lot of successful groups, teams and corporate organizations and so forth. If they have a shared vision of whatever it is, here's where we want to go. And then everything is oriented around that. And here's what I mean by that. Here's where we want to go. We want to be the best team in the NFL. We want to be, you know, the best basketball team. We want to be the best marketing team, et cetera. More details there, right? But the point is that we know where we want to go. Then the questions become really simple. Is what I'm doing right now achieving that goal, moving towards that goal, what we call the North Star? And if the answer is yes, keep doing it. If the answer is no, find something else that does, right? And so what one of the things that does is it gives you a very clear direction. But the other thing it does is it depersonalizes the feedback that you're given. You know, hey, Mark, you know, I'm trying to figure out how this is in the best interest of what we're trying to achieve. I'm not saying you're right or wrong. I'm just mm-hmm. trying to understand it, right? Or if you come forward with a proposal, and the question is, can you tie that to our North Star? Can you tell me how that feeds into it? And if you can, good. Let's do that. And if you can't, let's rethink it, right? None of that's about you. None of that's a judgment of you. That's whether or not we're achieving our goal towards the North Star, right? And so, you know, I'm convinced of this. When we make decisions that are in line with the mission of ourselves and or the organization, we're going to win, right? We're going to win consistently through that. And as soon as we stop making decisions, if we make decisions from an ego perspective, from a financial perspective, from a, you know, these things that are not mission driven,
mm-hmm.
I think you're really toying with losing on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, it makes me think about how often we make decisions from that place of trying to get something, you know, which I think the hard part is differentiating trying to achieve a goal versus, I mean, if a goal is financial, right? But for me, I then go to, okay, well, how do you tie a goal that's financial to a goal that's contribution or service? But not every business is in the service of service.
Right.
You know, and I think as soon as you get things like shareholders, then now you have the underlying intention of the organization is profit
mm-hmm.
because of shareholder value. And so then you lose the humanistic influence on that. But Zappos, were they publicly traded? I can't remember if they were.
Not at the time.
Not at the time.
No.
So they desired to be a human-centric. Like, what inspired them to bring you in?
A story about me working with a kicker one time.
Like with a football kicker?
Football kicker. And I'd met a person who his name's Fred Mosler, who eventually, I didn't know what Zappos was at the time.
Uh-huh.
And Fred and I met and we got talking. Somehow the story of this me working with a kicker came up. He said, "Hey, I have a friend that's interested in that, and would be interested in the story. You want to have lunch with us?" So I was at UNLV and had been at another university in Boston area and had come back. And I had some time, right, between getting back to my normal UNLV gig. And so I met this guy, Tony Shea, had no idea who he was. And we had a lunch and we walked back to the office and he offered me a job as we were walking back into the doors of the building. And
you didn't even know it was an interview.
I don't know that it was an interview. I think it became an interview during lunch. But essentially what Tony wanted was a couple of things. One, could I look at what they were doing generally, organizationally, training and so forth, and just consult and say, hey, here's where I think you're optimizing. Here's where I think you're suboptimal. Here's some suggestions, right? I think that was part of it. And then the other one is, can you work with our individuals to then create a culture that is in our long-term best interests? Mm-hmm. And so a combination of those things. Tony was remarkable at putting together pieces, and those pieces sometimes were people, right? But I think that that's really, you know, how it started. And then it sort of mushroomed from there. Fairly early on, Tony said, hey, you know, we'd like for you to start and run Zappos University. And I said, that sounds cool. What is Zappos University? And he said, we don't know. That's part of your job. Figure it out, right? And that's just the way things were. So in their case, their mission was around wowing customers, right? It was, how can we create the best customer experience? And decisions were made based on that idea. For example, when they very first started, they drop shipped. So they would get an order from somebody like for Nike, and they would call Nike and order it from Nike to get shipped off. Well, they decided, well, that's, we're not in control of when they get that package from Nike. Well, that is not a good customer experience. So we're going to stop drop shipping and we're going to get an inventory, which costs a lot of money, mm-hmm. and we're going to ship it ourselves. Well, all of a sudden they lose a lot of their brands. They lost over 50% of their business because of this. But to have better customer experience, that was the decision they needed to make.
Mm, right? I love that.
And then of course, you know, they became known as a customer experience. And there are so many things that Zappos did, like overnight shipping, when they were a small company, that now everybody tries to do. So to answer your question, Zappos was bought by Amazon and then they were publicly traded right at that point when they were bought by Amazon. But the other thing that I want to say, and I think that this is really important, you know, we're talking about financial goals. There's nothing wrong with financial goals.
Right.
But be honest about it, right? I mean, if financial goals are your goals, so be it. And then let's optimize for that.
Right.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, within reason, it doesn't matter what the goal is, but let's say it and be honest.
So we're clear so we can set the right challenge point to create that.
And that's exactly, you know, to getting back to the some of the things that you said, that happens in relationships as well and in families. Let's just talk about what we really want out of this and what we're trying to do and then optimize for that.
I think about this from there's a recent book I read called 10X is Easier Than 2X. One of the best business books I've read in the last while. It's by Dan Sullivan and Dr. Benjamin Hardy. Shout out to you guys. What it argues is that we spend so much of our time investing in tasks and customers that are actually not where we create revenue. And so, and I might butcher a little bit, but ideally that you are operating from your zone of genius, like your unique skill that you know you're one of the best at and that you're constantly creating from there, but also getting better at it the more you're in it. And one of the things they talk about, which I think is really interesting, is that if you're a realtor, it's a lot harder to get 20, you know, million-dollar listings than one $20 million listing, like in terms of time output. And not only that, but the actual experience of the customer goes way up when you have less customers. Mm-hmm. Now, like, that's a really interesting way of thinking, because I think a lot of the times we try to play a volume game or we try to do everything. And really having this idea of 80-20, because it seems like everything comes back to that, you know? And if we're optimizing a skill, it's not about, you know, if I want to learn the guitar, is a good idea to also be learning how to sing at the same time and how to golf and how to, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so is there some research that looks at, or is there just insight that you have about that diverse attention when you're trying to optimize something? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And there's some really interesting literature all around that. Nothing that's that I know of that's directly, but all around it. And it's really, I think it's really interesting. For example, if you get into, so you're familiar with flow states, right? So this sort of nirvana of time where everything seems to work wonderfully and so forth. You can set up what are called flow triggers. So you know, triggers that make it more likely that you can get into a flow state, or at the very least, you're in a sort of a hyper state towards optimizing towards flow. And if you do that, and you're trying to learn guitar for your situation, then you know, 30 minutes later, you decide you're going to learn French. Your physiology is still set up for optimized learning.
So you can transfer tasks.
You can transfer tasks.
Because you're in a neuroplastic state?
Yeah,
is that
that's
right?
That's exactly right. And
that's now, super interesting.
Yeah. But the thing that's, so there's going to be a couple of caveats here.
Yeah.
The thing that's interesting about this is that the counter to this is that if you were trying to learn something, and you had a learning about, and then you had either a deep rest, non-sleep or sleep or something where you weren't creating interference, then you're also going to be more likely to optimize learning, an effect called consolidation, okay? So those two things sound like they're saying something different,
yeah.
Right? So then the trick would be if you are learning two similar things, so that they can, you share certain things between the two of them within the same learning bout. And so I'm going to just call them A and B, right? So A may be guitar and B may be reading music in general, right? Mm-hmm. Independent of playing. So if you learn A and then, and you're still in this hyper learning state and you learn B, and then you come back and learn A again, now it's going to leverage all of the good things And then if you rest afterwards, or you have a bout with B and then you rest afterwards, now it leverages all of those, the physiology, the psychology, the overall state of learning, the all of these types of things, because you've combined the optimal state for learning, right? From a physiological and neurophysiological perspective, you have shared commonalities between the two that you can then use for each of those. And so there's some overlap between the two, and you've created what's called a randomized training schedule. Instead of it being AAA, BBB, it's ABAB. And then you've rested, which creates consolidation. And so the thing is that's really, and I know that sounds sort of complicated, but the thing that's really interesting about this to me is there are people who know how to optimize learning. Right. And you've got all these variables. It's like a menu that you can choose from, but you have to be able to choose wisely and based on the individual. Right. Some people could, maybe from a science perspective, this AB training is great, but it frustrates people. And so then it isn't great. Mm-hmm. Right. The whole point to this is there's science behind optimal learning, there's science behind optimal relationships and so forth. And if we can tap into that in an intelligent way, then we can help people to optimize whatever it is that they want to optimize. And then this gets back to the other piece, optimize for their goals, right? Whatever that goal happens to be.
So if someone has, let's just assume someone has the prerequisite psychological perspective, mm-hmm. right? Open to learning, humility, responsibility, perspective, seeking growth, seeing challenges, opportunity for growth. So they have that. Is what you're saying that when I, let's say, optimize for learning the guitar, what's going on when I am stumbling and learning a chord and getting it and then not 65% of the time is that neurologically and neurohormonally, I'm actually releasing the perfect cocktail that says reward, growth, learning, that then I'm primed to then change to another task. But that task then also has novelty. So it's a new task, or I'm again stretching a challenge. And then I can go back to the old task and sort of extend. Is there a time period that this has, just based on the research, that, you know, because now, you know, people don't even like TikTok videos longer than 30 seconds. Yeah. So will the high performance of the future not have this low capacity for boredom or what might be perceived as monotony?
Let's go back and simplify it one step before this.
Yeah.
So imagine that you're in a classroom, right? You're a student, let's say in a college classroom, and you're in there for an hour long lecture.
Yeah.
Right? And you get out of the lecture and your buddy says, "Hey, Mark, I missed class. What did you guys talk about?" And you're like, "I have no idea." Right.
That never would have happened.
Dude, weren't you in class? Yeah, I was there the whole time. I even took notes, but I have no idea what we talked about. The reason is, in that case, what potential reason is because you were bored out of your mind, right? And it's not just about being bored. Your physiology said, "Hey, look, if this was important, I would be interested. My arousal state would be higher, and I would automatically encode that information, take it in, right? But because my arousal state and probably my posture, by the way, I'm slouching my chair, were low, I was signaling to my brain, this can't be very important. So why are we going to waste, you know, energy to encode or store this information? I'm not. I'm just going to, and especially if I'm writing it down, I'll write it, but then I'll just dump it out of my memory because there's no point, right? So the other side's true too. If you go in and for whatever reason, you're really excited about the class, the topic, the teacher, whatever it happens to be, and same person asks you, "Hey, Mark, what did you do in class today?" "Oh, it's so cool. I did this and this and this and this." And you remember all these things, right? And we used to talk about creating a 40% retention rate from people walking out of class. And that doesn't sound like very much, but that may be a fourfold increase to what normally happens.
So 40% of students are retaining what they're learning in class.
A student would retain 40%.
Oh, okay.
Right. So, yeah.
So 40% of what they're exposed to.
Correct.
Okay.
Which sounds bad, but it's actually way better than what normally happens in a college classroom.
The online course completion rate on average is something like 8%.
Yeah, it's
so
crazy.
You know, if you can get it to 25, which that doesn't even sound good, the outcomes you're getting in students is much higher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it becomes more efficient. And the other piece about it is because I'm learning and because I'm engaged, all of my physiology, and I keep saying physiology because eventually, you know, we are physiological machines, right? And so all of my physiology tells me I want to go back to that class because there was some positive reward that happened through that experience, okay? So the point to this is that if we can create an optimized arousal state with and optimize is key, right? It's not more is better. Like you can be under aroused, you can be over aroused, optimized arousal state, then you're going to learn and you're going to feel better about the material and you will feel some degree of ownership. I would tell students this all the time. I don't want you to borrow this information for a test. I want you to own it for your life.
Mm. Right? And I borrowed a lot of information for multiple choice tests.
I think most of us do that, right?
Yeah.
Because it's an efficient way, quote unquote, efficient way, right? Why are we going to waste energy to save this stuff deep in our memory when we can just borrow it for a test because that's what's important? Well, unless we change our mind and decide that's not what's important. What's important is that I learn this material.
Well, I never thought of the arousal state, like the arousal being one of the contributing factors in that. When I look back at college, I did my undergraduate degree in finance. Not because I love finance, not because I love spreadsheets, but because I was good at marketing and I was like, I might as well just do finance because it's the hardest business degree and then I'll be able to read stock forms, which were confusing AF. And when I graduated, I never looked back at finance because I learned at how much like traders had to work and I was like, well, that's not a job for me. Instead, I became a pharmaceutical rep. But when I look back, one of my favorite classes in college, all my favorite classes were centered around human behavior. That's not a shock based on what I do today. But one of my favorites was psych of child development. And I remember being so eager to go to this class that was like a high level class for psych majors. And I had to get special approval to take it from the department. And I was so engaged because of that arousal state. I never would have labeled it that way. Probably because I associate arousal with other things.
Yeah.
But I get it that there's like this peak level of interest. And I think it's fascinating that my major was not chosen based on what brought me most alive. It was chosen based on what was most practical to be able to make a certain amount of money, to have a certain amount of mate value, to be a high perceived possibility, you know, be able to take care of a family. All the classic male messages were taught. And now I think about how much I think we now have this privileged opportunity, not everywhere in the world, but it's more so available today than it ever was, which is what brings you alive? What do you love? Can you follow that? Even if it's not a way that you monetize your life, but it's actually, if you go in that direction and learn how to grow there, to me, it's also like you can't go to the challenge point. In, let's say, a sport or in your discernment and discipline around food or around the pursuit of unavailability and relationship, that you can't do that and then it not translate. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, then you're like, wait, that's my edge there. Like, wait, if I don't have discipline choosing unavailable people and I start to develop that, it's going to be the same thing as saying no to sugar. Make sense?
Yeah, it does. So, by the way, just a note on arousal states. In 1908, Yerkes Dodson, two different guys, some people pronounce it Yerkes, I don't really know. But anyway, Yerkes Dodson published this paper that basically said that they measured arousal by neural excitation, right? So how much neural activity do you have in your body? And they said that as you increase arousal, you increase performance up to a point. And then when you go past that point, you're over aroused. So prior to that point, it's boredom. After that point, it's anxiety.
Interesting.
Yeah. the thing is, you said, I know you were referring to sex when you were talking about arousal before.
Yeah.
It's the same way with sex, right? If you're under aroused, bad, over aroused, bad,
yeah.
Right? There's an optimal state
so true.
There. And that the way that it is from a learning perspective is we're talking about an optimal arousal state that has that chemical cocktail that you're, you know, addressing that is magic. You know, and the other thing about it, I will credit Andrew Huberman with this. I think he's done a great job to make people aware of dopamine, not just during the state of learning, but in anticipation of the next time you go to learning, like the next time you go into that child development class, you started getting dopamine hits before you got into class because of anticipation of what you were going to get in class. And
anticipatory arousal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating system, right? It's fascinating that we're designed this way.
That's interesting because I know in some, I want to say it's positive psychology research, but it was that like when you experience, like when you get a gift of an experience versus a gift, the experience is associated with environment, right? There's a lot of physical sensations that are correlated, let's say, with a trip to Italy versus an amazing Italian dinner.
Yeah.
Right. An Italian shirt, right? Versus a trip to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, great, but the gift is momentary. The experience is something that you can actually go back to. And then you can say to someone, hey, what is it that you loved about that trip? And they can actually experience the arousal, the physiological memory, which I think is so fascinating.
Yeah.
Like how you said, like, I know we're talking about physiology, but we are beings. We are biological beings, and trying to negate physiology is actually ego. Like it's not taking into account that we are attracted to people who are unavailable because it infers high status.
Right.
Not because they're good for us, not because that's just chemistry and I have no choice. It's because from a mate value perspective, someone who has lots of competition doesn't have a lot of time for a lot of people. That's why books like The Game teach quote unquote unavailability, but it's not true self-worth. It's manufactured self-worth, which will always fail when we're in a high crisis, as you said, under stress.
Mm-hmm.
Under stress, you're not really who you pretend to be. I think about everything you're saying from a relational perspective, because I think about when we go through the honeymoon phase, we're in that high arousal state, literally, physiologically, all the things. And we're willing to push ourselves. We're willing to be better. I remember hearing this one quote that I love was like, always orient to your partner as if they're just a little out of your league.
Mm.
Like where both people are like, oh my God, how did I get you? And what that does, because when we think someone is out of our league, which obviously they're in your league because you got them, but let's just be with this, is that you're willing to do more. You're willing to become more.
Mm-hmm.
You're willing to grow, to continue to be able to be a desirable partner for them.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that you're not chosen, not to say that there's not psychological safety, all that kind of stuff. But I think when we look at the honeymoon phase, we have this like peak challenge, peak all this stuff. And then we stop going to that edge of what we're willing to do, what we're willing to become. We become settled into this new standard. But we stop growing. I think about long distance relationships. The reason they often have really high levels of relationship satisfaction, and actually we can learn a lot from them, is they're always going on new adventures.
Yeah.
We stop going on adventures so often. We actually pretend, we think that we know our partner. But like, there's no challenge if you think you know your partner. Like imagine in our friendship, if I'm like, well, I've learned everything that Mark has to teach me.
Yeah.
You know, which I'm like, I always look to conversations with you like, what the hell else am I going to learn today? So what do you think about the translation to sort of that continued evolution of relationship?
I think our relationship is probably going to end pretty soon based on what you just said, you know, that you are only in this to learn from me, but
yeah.
I think I'm done. No, I think you're exactly right. And I think it's really fascinating, right? Because the one of the things that's fascinating to me about this is we're talking about some really primal evolutionary stuff, right? We're not talking about modern world. And, you know, when we think about human nature is designed for number one, procreation of the species, right? So making sure that the species moves forward. And the best way to do that is to make sure that I, you know, as a member of the species, can get my my lineage to go, my genes to go forward. And the best way to do that is to stay safe. And but then I need a mate for that. And, you know, and so
I need a mate who will theoretically stick around.
Right.
I need a mate who has resources or is resourced.
And a mate that is better than me. Right. Yeah. Because that's how my genes pool to better,
diversify and grow. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So now we call it out of our league. And so to me, this is all really fascinating because we're not talking about 21st century, you know, stuff. We're talking about things that are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago, but we still are driven that direction. And I think the advantage that we have now is we have a prefrontal cortex that if we want to, we can override human nature. Again, human nature is designed for survival. It's not designed for greatness. Including greatness of relationships. And so if we want a great relationship, we can override certain aspects of human nature if we want to. For example,
that's interesting.
The relationship doesn't have to become stale. You talk about this a lot. You talk about, you know, challenging the relationship, right? Having those difficult conversations, having adventures, having these kinds of things. They don't just have to happen at the beginning of the relationship, right? You can do that anytime you want. And especially going back to the things we talked about before, especially if you two are on the same page of where you want the relationship to go. Asking the question, you know, either to yourself or to your partner, is what we're doing right now helping us towards that goal that we have?
Like that culture question you're
exactly.
talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. That journey, like when I think about that challenge point, because too much, right? Like, let's say there is a betrayal in the relationship. Mm-hmm. That can be too much of a challenge for a relationship. Too little, which is like, we don't even talk really. I don't challenge you at all. Like, I see that a lot when someone's behavior is maybe not ideal and the other person actually doesn't even challenge their behavior. There's a level of boredom and also a level of respect that starts to go out the window. It's often unconscious too, where the other person is like, they're going to let me get away with this. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't respect them anymore. And now, of course, that's not the optimal way to challenge someone, but I think we do it totally unconsciously.
Yeah.
But to think of that, there is this optimal level that we want to bring to our relationship that alchemizes it or like creates this experience of growth, and that it actually is our job to bring that to the relationship. Mm-hmm. And now if we're not doing it relationally, are we going to be doing it personally? Because I would say even the absence of bringing it to the relationship means that we're, in order to grow further psychologically, spiritually, I have to be doing it individually. And part of the individual growth of that is to do it in every area of my life. And if I'm avoiding it in my relationship, then I'm choosing a different learning curve. Fair?
Yeah. I mean, I think it may just be that what we're seeing in our relationship with other people is the same relationship that we have with ourselves. We're just not looking at it.
Like we're not willing to challenge ourselves beyond that.
We're not being able to make ourselves uncomfortable. We're not willing to make, to have the difficult conversation with ourselves. You know, we pacify ourselves. I mean, I think it would be an interesting exercise for someone to say, okay, let me look at the things I like and dislike about my relationship and see how that's a reflection of how I treat myself.
Like, where is that also reflective in my own?
Right. Where else does this show up in your life?
Where am I not telling the truth?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
For people listening, I'm curious, what are, to have some simple takeaways, what are maybe the top three things that someone can do to start to move towards that implementing challenge point into their lives? And where can they learn more about it?
I think...
Other than your book coming out.
Yeah. I think one of the first things is to understand that struggle, within reason, struggle is a really good thing. And related to that is if we then get excited about the struggle, right? This is where we get to choose, you know, like the dog horrible dog experiment I mentioned. If we have control over our struggle, read the book, Man's Search for Meaning, right? Mm. Viktor Frankl's story about how he reframed a difficult situation.
Wild.
It's unbelievable. But the point to that is he chose his attitude. He chose how he was going to interpret things. And we have that choice too. And so if we take the choice to look at every struggle as an opportunity, then we've got a much better chance to prosper from mm-hmm. it. So that's number one. Number two, the level of struggle has to be tailored to you as an individual. It's not more is better, right? It is that there is an optimal state of struggle. There's an optimal state of everything. And so for growth purposes, we want struggle that feels like we're failing 60 to 70%. Let's call it 65%, right? And what that means is that we're okay. We're not happy with failing. We're okay with it during preparation so that we don't fail when we're tested. Right. And that becomes really important.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it starts getting us to a point where we no longer fear failure. And that's one of the things that causes failure a lot is our fear of failure.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So I would say the mindset around it, seeing that everything is your advantage, including the struggle. And so then when you know you're struggling at that appropriate level, you get excited about it, which then changes your physiology, which then makes you learn much more, much quicker and deeper. I think that those things are probably the biggest key things as far as learning specifically is there. And then to a point that you bring up, which I think is so, so valuable, because ultimately I think the root of this is the relationship that you have with yourself that allows you to do this, right? Allows you to embrace struggle. How can you use this, all the things that we're talking about, with your relationship with yourself? And then that will extend to your relationship with others, that will extend to your relationship with skills that you're trying to learn, the culture that you're trying to create, on and on and on. And then the only last thing I would say is the secret sauce to this is being very clear about what your goals are, where you're trying to go, and make sure that everything's optimized for that. You can answer the question of how what you're doing right now serves that ultimate goal.
How would someone know that they are not challenging themselves enough?
It's interesting because people almost always know if they will let themselves.
It's like a trick question, right?
Yeah. But knowing and being aware of it are two different things, right? You have to have a sense of it. I was at the gym this morning. And I was working out. I knew if I was challenging myself enough at the right level,
yeah.
Right? And sometimes, a lot of times, that means you push yourself harder. But sometimes that means you back off because you need some kind of, active or passive recovery. But for the most part, like as a general rule, if you've got, say, 65% success on whatever it is that you're doing. So you and I both play golf. If I can hit the ball off of the ground 6 or 7 times out of 10, that may be successful for me, right? As a if
that
I
sounds
were
not bad,
a new golfer.
Oh, new golfer! Shit.
For you, an expert golfer, maybe you need to hit a green from 150 yards away 6 or 7 out of 10 times, right? For an elite level player, maybe they hit the left side of the green.
Six or seven
wow. out of 10 times, yeah. Right? And so you adjust your criteria of success. Now, to somebody just watching, they're going to look at that, player, the like PGA player, and they've hit the green 10 out of 10 times, but they've only hit the left side six or seven out of 10 times. That's a 65% success rate for them, but somebody watching says that's 100% success. It's about your criteria that you're setting up, right? And criteria can be something as simple as, like, I'll tell you something that can dramatically change a student's success rate in class. Simple things that take no time. One, you sit where you're uncomfortable. Like if you're most comfortable sitting at the back of the room, go to the middle of the room or go to the front of the room, right? Sit someplace that you're uncomfortable. That's going to raise your arousal state, increase your learning. Two, ask or answer a question in class. Now, a lot of teachers don't allow time for you to ask or answer a question. Obviously, I'm talking about, in this case, an in-person class. So do it for yourself. Write down a question and say, okay, today in class, I'm going to sit in an uncomfortable place and I'm going to ask one question and answer one question in my notebook.
Mm.
Just that dramatically changes your learning. And if it's an online class, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to turn off my phone before I start, and I'm going to answer and ask one question, and I'll have my face on screen the whole time. Right?
That's a big difference. Yeah.
Big difference.
Yeah.
Right?
It's easy to hide.
Yeah.
It's easy to hide. I could see how sitting in a different part of the class would completely change, because you'd be in a bit of that protective state, which would make you more aroused, which is something you're out of your comfort zone.
Right.
So really moving to that space of being willing to challenge ourselves.
Being not just willing, but excited about the...
Seeking it.
Seeking the challenge.
God, can you imagine if we oriented to life from that, which yeah. I think if we all did that, anything's possible.
Yeah.
You know, elite in whatever desired direction we want to be.
And you asked the question before about how can you change a group of people or a culture? If that culture seeked out challenge towards the goal of that group, holy crap,
right?
They're off the charts, right?
Seems you know, something
and,
possible.
And I will tell you, I saw a lot of that at Zappos. I see a lot of that at Grammarly now, you know, work with that company as well. And I see a lot of it in companies that have great cultures and are very successful.
Those cultures inviting challenge, inviting discourse, isn't it interesting? All the highest functioning human systems and going from meta culture to not meta's culture, but meta being large perspective culture to interpersonal, that willingness to see challenge as opportunity for expansion.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's the center point of how we orient as a culture, oh my gosh, like we'd see each other as a gift, the differences, which I think it's so obvious that diversity of thought and everything, diversity of everything increases the productivity and expansion of a system always, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying, and I agree with this 100%, you're choosing growth over ego.
Mm-hmm.
And when you choose growth over ego, then it's not about the other person, first of all. It's not about how you look. It's not about what you do. It's how can I or we gain? And so when you're in a situation, if you are in a situation where everybody's looking to grow, everybody's looking to be better as an organization and to help others be better as an organization, that's not an ego organization. That's a growth organization.
Yeah.
And that one is off the charts.
Man, what a difference that makes for everything. If families could be like that, like just families alone, where we're like, let's go to the truth. Let's embrace challenge at family dinner.
Yeah.
Dr. G, love talking to you. Thanks so much taking the time to share your wisdom. And for everyone listening, where can they find more of you?
Let's see. Instagram is Mark Guadagnoli, but you'd have to spell it. So
we'll put the link in the show notes.
So at the School of Medicine, we have podcasts and Instagram and so forth. It's the Academy at the Kirkorian School of Medicine. You could just put UNLV School of Medicine.
Yeah, we'll link that out
as well. Yeah, and those are probably the two best ways.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.